Welcome to the show, Wish Upon a Star. I'm your host, Andell Banks. Wish Upon a Star is an exciting program that will showcase up-and-coming stars in the musical, visual, performing, creative, and literary arts arena. We will discuss with professional guests about songwriting, entertainment law, copywriting, and other topics of importance in this highly competitive industry. Today, it gives us great pleasure and an honor to introduce our guest, Ms. Cheryl Slay Carr. Ms. Carr's background. Ms. Carr is Associate Professor of Music Business at Belmont University. As a professor, she has taught and designed courses including copyright law, music industry contract law, legal issues in the entertainment industry, and understanding the jazz business. Cheryl is co-author of Music Copyright Law and a contributing author to the ABA, BNA published book, Trademark Infringement Remedies. Ms. Carr has nearly 14 years of experience as an intellectual property and entertainment law attorney in representing independent and emerging filmmakers, novelists, record companies, musicians, technology companies, visual artists, technology and business professionals. Cheryl also has 17 years of experience in developing public policy through managing and advising public sector programs. She received her Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Michigan, a Master of Public Administration from Atlanta University, and received her Juris Doctor degree from the University of Maryland School of Law. Cheryl completed the Harvard Law School Program of Instruction for Lawyers in International and Comparative Intellectual Property. She is also a member of the Board of Directors of Jazz Education Network and was selected as a Maryland Bar Foundation Fellow and is an alumna of Leadership Music. Ms. Slay is also a jazz, gospel, R&B vocalist with 25-plus years of performance experience, which augments her entertainment business expertise. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, Cheryl. Cheryl, we would like to begin with just some general questions, if that's all right with you.
That sounds great.
Everybody thinks that being an entertainment attorney sounds very glamorous, like rubbing shoulders with celebrities. But what does an entertainment attorney do?
That's a great question, and it is a good way of sort of beginning this discussion with the popular perception of entertainment lawyers and the reality of being an entertainment lawyer. And some of it really depends on the nature of your practice. So certainly, if you are based in L.A. or New York, it's entirely possible that your practice is very concentrated. Maybe you only deal with film clients if you're in L.A., or you only deal with theater clients if you're in New York. I started out being based in Maryland in the Baltimore area, and so as a practical matter, I really had to have a practice that had a variety of entertainment sectors. So that's in terms of scope. And in terms of who I've actually dealt with, I certainly have had the opportunity to hobnob with a few celebrities, but truly my practice really focused on the emerging independent artist, business professional. So folks who are down in the trenches really building their careers, and the scope of my practice, therefore, was very much to help in that building. So it can be glamorous. Everybody approaches it a little bit differently. I am a lawyer, and so I really focused my expertise on understanding the law because that's what I knew that clients didn't know that I could help them with.
Oh, excellent. So in that particular area, and like you said, we appreciate the fact that we are in Baltimore, Maryland, that is a great legacy. So in those particular areas, what are some of the issues that you can find and give an example for the entertainment professional?
Okay, so frequently, if someone is consulting an entertainment lawyer, the kinds of things that they would ask me would be about starting an entertainment business. So someone would ask me, how do I start a record company or a publishing company? Or how do I really begin to make money in this field? How can I get the attention of record companies and publishers? How can I get my music heard? How can I get started as a songwriter? How can I protect myself? How can I keep people from stealing my music or from stealing my ideas or the name of my singing group? How can I protect myself as a member of a singing group? How can I go from the music industry into literary publishing books? Or how can I go from music into film? Or I certainly also counseled folks who were not in the music industry, but who were already in other sectors of the entertainment industry. So there's quite a big range of questions that people want to understand so that they can conduct themselves as professionals in the entertainment industries and therefore understand not just how to create the art, which is, of course, really important. You need to bring your talent, your skills, whether that's writing or filmmaking or singing or writing music. You need to be able to maximize and use those talents and abilities, but as a practical matter, we all have to earn a living. So how an individual could take those skills and really conduct him or herself as a professional so that the outcome would be to be able to make a living, to make money, to be protected, to be prolific, all of those kinds of pursuits. An entertainment attorney can help by introducing the legal issues that are involved and blend that art and business.
Oh, I see. That is very encumbersome. Since we are talking about music and that's your expertise, we're going to sort of stay with that trend. Okay, Cheryl, I have a CD. I just finished it. I did the demo, and now I'm ready to put it on the market and become a star. When is it a good time to consult an entertainment attorney?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you have already done those things, it's good to check in with an attorney still to make sure that as you are looking to make that information public, that public can enjoy what you've created and also have access to what you've created without you jeopardizing what you've created. So you've done a demo. Some questions that you would want to check in with an attorney about. Have you copyrighted the music in the demo? Has it been protected? And by that, copywriting means, have you taken that music and sent a sample of it to the U.S. Copyright Office for them to register it and for it to become a part of that registration process? That would be one thing. Have you engaged others to help you in that process? So let's say that you are a singer. In creating that demo, did you engage other musicians that are accompanying you? And if so, do you have contracts with them? Do they think that they have partial ownership of the music that you've created? Do they have 100% ownership of the music that's been created? Have you contractually thought through what those relationships are for people who might have been involved in the project?
I see. And that's sound advice, too. Okay. We have hired you, Cheryl, as our entertainment attorney, and the firm as well. Who else do musicians and artists really need on their team as a startup?
One of the suggestions that I make is that you have an accountant, a manager, an agent, and probably someone to help with publicity and marketing. So the difference between a manager and an agent is that a manager is someone who helps you to plan your career. It's really the terminology that we're using within the industry for a career counselor. We don't call them that in the music industry, but that's really kind of the function and the purpose that they play. Whereas an agent helps you to actually get gigs. They actually help to book you in different places. So that's different from a manager. An agent may not really be able to help you think long-term about your career and how you're going to continue to be viable. They may just make sure that you have employment opportunities, and they find those opportunities for you, and as a result, you give them a commission on the gigs that they're able to get for you. And then in terms of PR and marketing, you can create wonderfully beautiful music, but if nobody ever hears it or knows anything about you, then you probably haven't really established the goals that you really meant to or to accomplish those goals. So they can help you to get the attention that you're looking for. An accountant is helpful because if you want to be able to focus on the music, you need somebody taking care of the business and thinking about how much you're taking in and how much you need to project to think about planning for the future. So those are the folks that I would start with. And they should each have their own requisite areas of expertise. And in that way, even if you don't have all of that knowledge, that's okay, because you're delegating those responsibilities to somebody else to help you understand things that you may not be aware of.
Great. All right, that's true, because we are novice. We have taken your advice. We have got an account, an agent, a manager. Matter of fact, we've got other positions, and now we have a bank or do what you want to do band. Tell us now, what are some of the things that we need to do before we sign a contract? Somebody has approached it. A producer has said, okay, I like what you do. But Cheryl, when should we, what should we do before we sign a contract? Because everybody knows once you sign on that dotted line.
So true. And the way that the law looks at anyone who is 18 years of age or older is that you're responsible for what you sign. And by signing, you are stating that you understand it, even if you haven't, and you're stating that you've read it, even if you haven't, because the law assumes and believes that people won't sign things that they don't read and things that they don't understand. So you're absolutely right that once you sign, you are obligated, you are committed legally to carry out the obligations that are set forth in that contract. So if you're in a band, which is the scenario that you presented to me, bands are tricky. They're good experiences because they're collaborative team opportunities and you can play on each other's strength. That's great artistically. But from a legal perspective, the law views our band as really a collection of individuals, and therefore you have legal rights and I have legal rights and all of the other individuals in the band have their own individual legal rights. So the first thing to do, even before you sign the contract, is if you are constituting yourselves as a band, to make some decisions about how you want to be viewed as a band. So you can incorporate yourselves, you can set up a corporation that corporation is your band, or you can set up a limited liability company, which is your band, And then you have an agreement between all of the band members about who's going to be the lead singer and who's, how are we going to split royalties and how are we going to split profits and who's going to own equipment and who's going to own the name of the band. Are we all going to own the name of the band? And what happens if I own the name of the band, but then I decide that I want to leave and go off on my own? So you have a document, even before you sign a contract with anybody outside the band, have an internal agreement between members of the band, and that really helps to preserve those relationships within the band. So let's assume that you have that, though, that you've already taken care of that, that the band has established itself as a legal entity, and it has its own internal agreement. Now when you go to sign with a record company and you are reviewing that contract, you can have an attorney look at that contract for the entire band. If you don't do that, then the attorney is going to look at the contract for how it affects one person in that band or one individual within that band. But assuming that you have done that, then the next thing to do is to you have your choice of doing one or two things. So I do like for people to understand that you're not required to have a contract reviewed by an attorney. You're not required to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The law is not going to force you to hire an attorney. But it's in your best interest to make sure that you really do understand the legal obligations that you're about to undertake. And so it's good to go to an attorney to do that. But before you do that, everybody in the band should go ahead and read it carefully. Just take a read through it. And don't feel intimidated by that. Don't tell yourself, I don't know what I'm doing because I'm not an attorney. Remember, if you're going to have an attorney review the contract anyway, then the purpose for you reading the contract is different than the purpose for the attorney reading it. If you're reading it, you're reading it so that you can ask intelligent questions of your attorney, and that will really be helpful for your lawyer, because there are things that might be important to you that you want to raise, and there's no way for the attorney to know that without you telling them. So you read the contract, then you sit down with the attorney, and you ask questions openly. And if you happen to have engaged an attorney that you do not feel comfortable talking to, you don't feel comfortable asking your simple questions, and there's no question that's too simple that you should feel embarrassed about asking, then maybe you've chosen the wrong attorney if you don't have that comfort level. But if you have that comfort level, ask them whatever questions you have. And then it's a matter of suggesting changes. Those changes and suggestions are going to come from the attorney, but they're not going to be able to do as good a job if they don't have an idea of what you want. What is it that you're looking for? So before you enter the contract, think about your career goals. What is it that you want to accomplish? Do you want to be in a contract with a record company that is exclusive for a period of 1 year? Or a period of 5 years? Are you thinking that maybe at some point you're not going to want to be in this band any longer? Are you thinking that maybe you're not going to want to be with this record company? Maybe you want to have a trial period with them.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things affect how you review the contract.
All right. What informative information. We're going to take a little break and let you get a sip of water, Cheryl, and we'll be right back.
Thank
with an
you.
Intermission of a song by John Butler. Welcome back. This is your host on Wish Upon a Star, Andell Banks, with our honored guest, Ms. Cheryl Slay Carr. And we shall continue. Cheryl, we got the information, very informative, about making sure that you know your legal obligations on a contract, that we must read it carefully. But we, as band members, are novice, and we think we understand it, but we may not. Is there any kind of indication somewhere there's a sign to let us know that we're making a bad or good deal?
Well, I like to advise clients that I have that one of the red flags, things that should get your attention and maybe make you think twice, is if someone asks you to sign a contract really quickly. Think about if you were buying a house.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to buy a house, you look it over and you decide whether you like it or not. Maybe that's something you'll decide quickly. Maybe it's something that you need time. But whatever individual sort of perspective you have on it, you would be very, very suspicious of the real estate agent or the seller who says that the opportunity is going to last for some unreasonable period of time that's really, really short. That would maybe make you wonder if there's something about that house that they don't want you to find out, maybe something that they don't want you to discover. And the same thing is true with having a deal on the table that has no obvious time constraints. If there are time constraints, then whoever it is that's on the other side of the deal should be able to tell you what those are. And sometimes those exist. Every now and then, there really is something that's happening that's important, and time is of the essence. But that's something that you should be able to ask, and you should get a real clear answer on. So if someone says, if you don't hurry up and sign this contract, then I can't guarantee you that this opportunity is going to last, that should make you at a minimum ask more questions about why the time frames are what they are. Another sign is if you're ever asked to put money up front.
Oh.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah, if someone, there used to be lots of companies out there calling themselves record companies, but they're really something else. They're sham organizations that play on the fact that lots of folks are trying to get into this industry, and some people will do just about anything to break in. And so if you have someone who takes an interest in you and says, hey, I think you're talented, I really think that I can create opportunities for you, maybe I can even make you a star, and you say, okay, what do I need to do? And one of the things that they say that you need to do is, well, first thing you need to do is to put X number of dollars up front. You need to pay me. And even if they can say, here are the things that I'm going to do with the money. I'm going to do this. I'm going to take photos for you. I'm going to find you some initial gig. I'm going to create some buzz in the community. Whatever it is, even if they can explain it to you, a real record company should never ask you to take money out of your pocket to give to them. That's just not how it works.
Okay, now we're talking about deals, and you come across while we're sitting there at the table, and somebody says, what about a music publishing deal? Just what is a music publishing deal?
So the main types of deals that we have in music are, and these are the main ones, and I don't want folks to feel like their careers are restricted to only these two, but these are the main two. And if we have time later and we want to talk about other types of deals, and I'm happy to do that. But the two main types of deals are record deals and publishing deals. A record deal is a deal whereby a record company wants to sign you, meaning essentially hire you, even though they're not going to be your employer in the strict sense of the word. But for sake of, you know, simplifying the analogy, they're like an employer. They're going to hire you, and they are going to provide all of the resources to create some kind of a recording. It could be an album or it could be a single. But they're going to provide all the resources that are needed, the studio, the musicians, all of that kind of thing. And in exchange for receiving your talent, they're going to give you some kind of a royalty. It's going to be a percentage. And that royalty is going to be on records sold.
Okay.
So that's the whole purpose of the recording deal, is to make records. And they're going to give you a percentage of the records that get sold. Hopefully, records sell. If they don't sell, there's no money really to be made. But a record deal is very straightforward in that sense. Records get sold, you get a percentage. How much of a percentage? It depends on what you negotiate and what they're willing to give you as a percentage. And it really ranges. If you were someone who is an established, well-known artist and you've got a real track record of sales, you can ask for a much higher royalty than somebody who's brand new and we don't know whether anybody's going to be interested in buying you on recorded medium or not. So that's the one. That's a record deal. And this is what most people think is the way to make money and get rich and
right, and
really make a living in the industry. That's one. The other big type of deal is the publishing deal, which publishing is really referring to ownership of copyrights. So ownership of copyrights means that it's just like ownership of anything else. If I own a home, then I am able to do whatever I want to do with it. I can sell it. I can rent it. I can make whatever kind of use of that property I want to. And that's what a publishing deal is. So
let's say
that I am someone who I'm really not that musically talented in terms of I don't have a great singing voice. I don't really have the ability to perform in ways that others would find really engaging or interesting, but I can write music. I can do that. Well, if I can do that, I can make money selling that music to people who can perform it. And also, I can make money selling that music for lots of other purposes. I can make money on that music if it's played in commercials, if it's played in movies, if it's played on the radio, if it's performed in nightclubs, and I don't ever have to be present and performing any of it myself. I'm just basically licensing the rights, like renting a house. I'm licensing the rights so other people can use the music, and that's good for me because every time they use my music, I get paid.
Oh, great.
So a publishing deal is a deal in which you create opportunities through your copyright ownership of the music to publish, make available to the public in all the ways that I just described the music, and in return I get different income streams from that. But the thing that's different between a recording deal and a publishing deal is for a record deal, I don't need to be able to write music, and I will not probably have any copyright ownership in that music whatsoever. So 100% of my income from a record deal is going to come from whether records are sold. With a publishing deal, the sources of revenue could be lots and lots of different sources. Some of it could be from sales of records, and I get some percentage, even though I'm not the artist, I'm not singing on it, I'm not playing on it. Just because I own the music, I can get a percentage of the revenues from the sales of records. But I could also get sources of income from other uses of the same music.
All right. That also answers my next question. But we're going to take another little pause, and we'll be right back with Cheryl, ladies and gentlemen. This is Andell Banks on Wish Upon a Star, your host, with our honored guest, Ms. Cheryl Slay Carr. We can hear a little song by El DeBarge.
Right. Let's get loose.
District.
Yeah.
That thing.
What up, y'all? Just came to your city to say what's up.
What up?
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Show me love.
Show me love.
Hey.
Hop off the plane to a new show.
What up?
And all the shorties, they be waiting on me. Thugs packing they pistols.
Well, we're back with Miss Cheryl Slay Carr, entertainment attorney. Cheryl, that was very informative because, like I said, my next question would be just, you know, who needs a music publishing deal? And you've explained that very well. In some of my research, I have seen where they say statistics are very dim when calculating how much money a musician can make in the music industry. They have, and I quote, a multi-platinum album can guarantee a profit from sales after recoupable expenses are paid, unquote. So tell me, Cheryl, how often does that happen, and how does one make any money in the music industry?
Yeah, it's a great question, and this is also a contractual issue. So when recoupable expenses are mentioned, the reference there is to the record company's right through the contract to, before they pay their artists or other talent, like the side musicians who might play background music on the particular cuts that are involved, before any of those people receive any money from sales, the record mm-hmm. company gets the opportunity to reimburse itself for any expenses that it incurred in creating the recording. So in my description of what the record company does, they pay for studio time. They get to pay themselves back for the studio time. They pay for publicity. They get to pay themselves back for that publicity. Anything that they pay for out of their own pockets, they reimburse themselves before they ever share one dime
wow.
with the artists who are signed with them. Now, this is why you find a lot of artists who have experienced some real frustration with their mm-hmm. record deals. Prince left his record company when he was Prince.
Right.
Now going by a different performance name, but he found that sort of like, why am I, and he's not the only one, I'm just using him as an example, but why am I, the talent, not making more of the money when, if it weren't for me, there really wouldn't be any money to be made? So the reason that the record company feels entitled, however, to reimburse itself is because it's the one that puts out that money. And it's, by its logic, there wouldn't be any record. Even if you have talent, there wouldn't be any record because it costs money to create a record.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs money to publicize, promote the record, get it on the radio. You know, you've got to pay for the use of the music if your artist doesn't own it. That's, again, that copyright issue. So it's an expensive endeavor to be a record company. And in order for them to turn a profit, they will put in their contracts that they need to be able to reimburse themselves for any out-of-pocket expenses that they've incurred before they have to share anything. So it just depends in terms of answering your question about how you make money. It just depends on how much money has been spent in creating and promoting that record and how many records have actually been sold. And the simple math is, if the amount of money, the expenses, exceed the number of records sold, there's not going to be a profit there. But if the number of records sold exceeds the expenses, then there will be a profit. How much profit? It depends on how many records were sold. And that's why it's important to sell lots and lots and lots and lots of records. But can anybody guarantee that the public is going to want to buy that many to even make it economically worthwhile? So it can be really difficult to make money.
Oh, I see. And right on the piggyback of that is some sad stories. We know about Toni Braxton, Hendrix, TLC, and even Ballad of the Supremes. She died on welfare. So
yeah.
Thanks so much for that comment. What we're going to do now is take another little short break, give you a chance to catch your breath, and we've got some real more exciting things to talk about, Cheryl. We're going to hear a little tune by B. Howard.
You grooving already? We're going to make y'all dance on this one. Introducing my man, B. Howard.
I don't need a reason to groove all night.
Welcome back. This is Andell Banks, your host on Wish Upon a Star, with our honored guest, Ms. Cheryl Slay Carr. Now, Cheryl, we're going to really get into the heavy thing, copyright infringement. This seems to be on the radar all the time in the radio, on the television, and especially, of course, in the music industry. When is it all right to perform a song that was written by someone else?
Well, the answer to this question is not an answer that people really want to hear, and sometimes can hardly even believe what the answer to this question is. And the quick answer is never, unless you have the permission.
Oh, okay.
Now, I said that's the quick answer because there is an exception in copyright law called fair use. Fair use is a defense. It's not a right that a non-copyright owner has. So in other words, the nature of copyright ownership is that the law, the copyright law, gives to owners of copyrights exclusive rights, meaning them and only them have 100% of rights ownership. And therefore, all others, you, me, and everybody else who is not a copyright owner, is excluded from using that work unless they have either the permission of the copyright owner, that's a license, or they have an exception in the law, and there are a limited number of exceptions that are spelled out in the copyright law and all of the different hoops that you need to jump through in order to take advantage of those exceptions in the law. And then there is the fair use defense, and there are other defenses besides fair use, but this is the one that people are the most familiar with generally. And fair use in its spirit is really to allow for free speech, a constitutional privilege that we as citizens have in the United States. And so it's really connected to that. It's not just to allow non-copyright owners to use music without having to have a license or to have an exemption from the law. It really is about specific purposes that the law outlines. But if you can meet one of those purposes, according to these four criteria that are set forth in the law, then you may be able to use a piece of music or a photograph or other kind of copyrighted work without actually getting a license from the copyright owner. But that is a very, very dicey thing to do, and it's best to understand the ways in which you can use it. So the very best thing to do is to seek a license for the use that you need to make.
That is one of the subjects I know our listeners want to hear more and more about. Okay, let's break it down. Let's say, like I am, a DJ. How does that interject in that particular phase that you just finished saying about infringement? Let's say you're a DJ, or I have a friend who writes plays and she sing songs in the play. Now, how would that affect using other people's music?
Yes, it's great to have examples, so I appreciate the opportunity to break it down with examples. So when we're talking about a DJ's use of music, we're talking about one of the six exclusive rights under copyright.
Okay.
There are six rights that belong to the copyright owner. And when we talk about DJs, we're talking about performance. Because when you play a song on the radio, that's considered performing the song. Performance has a broader meaning than just being in front of an audience. In the law, it's defined also as playing it on a medium like radio. And so since performing a song is the exclusive right of the copyright owner, then that means that you have to get a performance license. That's the type of license that you would need to get in order to be able to play the song on the radio if you're a DJ. And this has become more complicated because songs are recorded. And before the song is recorded, it's just a musical composition. The person has written the song. It exists as a musical composition, a series of notes and chord progressions, and that's the song. But the minute that you record that song, now you've created another copyright work, which is the sound recording. And so you wind up having to get permissions for both use of the sound recording and use of the song itself. Even though they're combined maybe in one medium, it's still two different copyright materials, two different works. And so the law requires, for digital performance anyway, you've got to get the sound recording copyright ownership license as well. So anyway, to summarize, what a DJ would need would be a performance license. For the other example that you gave me, for a playwright who wants to use a song in the performance of a play,
yeah,
it's also a performance license.
Okay.
And therefore, that would also require going to the copyright owner and getting a performance license. And licenses are not always expensive. It really depends on who you're getting it from. If your listeners are familiar with ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, and now Sound Exchange for sound recordings, performance licenses through those organizations will really depend on whether or not the owner of the copyright is registered with one of those. If they're not registered with one of those, though unlikely, you might be able to negotiate something for performance that is very doable.
Oh, okay. I definitely want to have you back again. Can we really put you down, Cheryl? Because I've got thousands of questions. I'm sure our listeners have too.
There's so
much. Maybe later on in the month to have you come back?
I would be happy to come back, and we can figure out what the best time is in terms of schedule. And may I just say one more thing? Thank you for having me on, and I appreciate the opportunity to help educate folks about these really kind of complex issues.
Absolutely, and I enjoyed every moment. I was so involved in it. Now, is there any place our listeners can go to get some more information on these wonderful topics?
Well, I'm glad you asked, since I wrote a book on one of these topics.
Oh,
and I'm happy to in the department of plugging my own book, shamelessly plug.
Absolutely, go right ahead.
But the name of the book is Music Copyright Law. It's available on Amazon.com. It's available both in regular paper, or you can also download it in e-electronic format. The authors are me. My maiden name, Cheryl Slay, is one of the authors, and Moser, M-O-S-E-R, is the other author, Music Copyright Law.
Wonderful. Cheryl, thanks again. And we will be contacting you again. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Andale Banks, and our honored guest, Ms. Cheryl Slay Carter. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Wish Upon a Star, ladies and gentlemen. If you wish to become a guest, please send an email with comments and suggestions to musicradio34@gmail.com. Let me repeat that. musicradio34@gmail.com. This is Andale, your host, and Denise, our coordinator, saying, keep reaching for the stars. We will finally say good day to you with a song by Fire.